We always want people to listen to the iSpy Radio show on the radio, but we also know that sometimes you might be trapped under a refrigerator and can't get to the radio. And we also have guests on who get pretty deep into their subject, and you might think, now hold on, I need to hear that one again. And that's why we have the podcast version of the show. The iSpy Radio show is on all of the major podcast platforms, and if you're listening on one of those platforms, do us a big favor and give us a thumbs up or like and subscribe. That helps other people find us. Spread the word for good information with just a couple of little clicks, and thanks for doing that.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the iSpy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
The following is a speech I gave to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon on April 10th, 2025. Due to time constraints for the radio and because I went a little bit long, I did have to do some trimming, including taking out one of the videos. However, you can visit the page for that speech at iSpyRadio.com/CCRW2025 to find the links to some resources, including that video.
So the problem with giving a speech about faith is that people might expect you to be nicer than you actually are. And I can't make any promises on the other side of this. But seriously, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate this opportunity very much to talk about faith in particular. Some fairly recent evidence from science that could strengthen your faith because it points to Creator. And in science, you don't say it proves something or that it's conclusive. They will say things like it indicates such a thing. And so they don't, even the scientists that truly believe this, they don't necessarily say it proves that there's a Creator. But when you hear some of the evidence, you're going to think, I don't know how it can do anything but prove that there's a Creator. But it's a shame, really, that some of this doesn't get more attention. Of course, we live in a secular world, and it's a secular press, it's a secular academics, all the rest. And so when you hear some of these things, you think, oh my gosh, why haven't I heard this before? And some of you may have. I don't know what your experience is. But when you're talking a secular society, they're not going to promote something that obviously shows that there's a God, or there's a Creator, because when you have that knowledge, it requires something from you. And there is an information war on right now. We've seen massive disinformation, for heaven's sakes, during the whole COVID era. I would never have believed that we would have our own government sponsoring censorship. It's one thing when the media does it because, you know, they're private industries, but our own government, whose job, whose sacred duty is to protect our rights. And they failed. They not only failed, but they did the exact opposite, where they were censoring people that didn't agree with what they had to say. And in the information war, it's not just what they're telling you, but it's what they're keeping from you as well. And we certainly see that with healthcare. We certainly see that in a lot of areas. And that got me to thinking, what's the future going to be like? And that's, I kind of had a taste of that a few weeks back because I was doing some research for a show that I wasn't really very familiar on, things that had to do with cloud seeding. And so I started off my search on AI, and I don't know if you've used this or not, but it's a remarkable tool. It really is. And what's really cool, and the one that I used was Grok, that's the one based on X, and that's a little unique because it not only looks for academic papers, it will look for websites, it will also then look on X to see what people are saying about those topics. And so it's kind of a unique approach to things. But as with most technology, it ended in an argument because it was pretty clear that it was a firm believer in global warming. And I think that's some of what we're facing in the future here, is that control of information. We're already at a war over information. We've had a little bit of a reprieve thanks to Trump getting into office. They've disbanded the Office of Censorship that they had put together. But the problem is that as AI continues to grow, and it is, I mean, they're already gearing a large parts of our economy around AI. And we know how kids are with technology. They're going to adapt to it first. And I think that's where it gets into danger, because with any technology, it's garbage in, garbage out. And so if it's relying on academic papers that have been paid to find global warming, what's it going to find? And so the problem is that once kids start hooking into that, and once a belief is established, it becomes very hard to shake them from that. I guess as I was thinking about that argument with him, it got me thinking, in the future, what will it do about Christianity? How will it filter faith? And I think that's the big thing, is that AI, any technology really, is a filter. It's not just a tool, it's a filter as well. And so I think that's going to be something to look for all of us to keep our eye on. My goal today is to engage the intellectual side of faith. Your mind, not just your heart, but we need reason to strengthen our faith, to know, not just feel, but to know that God is really there. And what you'll hear today is the extent that God has gone to make life here on earth possible. And there's some truly fascinating and mind-boggling evidence. And I'm not here to argue doctrine or matters of science. I have a background in training in science and the scientific method, but I'm not an expert in these particular scientific fields. I'm just here to share what I've learned and hope that it touches your mind and heart, as I said. Also, some real quick generalities. When I say things like faith, I'm talking in general terms. I'm not referring to a particular faith. I'm not referring to a particular religion. I am a Protestant, and so that's kind of my lens there. And also, when I talk about science or scientists, not all scientists are evolved equally. So some of them are very devout Christians, as you'll hear. Actually, the polls show that the vast majority of many scientists are agnostic. So it's not that they don't believe in God, but it's just they're not necessarily convinced by their own evidence, which is really interesting because Dr. Hugh Ross, which is one of the people I cite quite often here, when he's talked to people, to scientists, he says a lot of them are just so excited about their work. He said one guy said it's like a video game. I just can't stop. I'm addicted to it, and my research is just so fascinating that they don't stop to think about it, about the implications of it. But there is certainly a hostility within some segments of science, and you'll hear that in a little bit, and also in the media that promotes it, is that there is certainly a hostility to faith and religion. As many of you know, Carla, who's also the producer for iSpy, got very sick last year. In fact, today it's 1 year and 1 week that it's been 1 year and 1 week, and she actually went into the hospital Good Friday morning, woke up one day, and just woke up that day, and could not walk, couldn't stand. And it was like something had switched her legs off. And so we went in the hospital, they ran a whole bunch of tests, they eventually decided, the going theory is that it's transverse myelitis, and effectively what happens is shorting out the nerves in her spine. It's not it's like chewing the insulation off electrical wires. Rag gets in there, things short out. And that's kind of the same thing that's happening to her. Well, they started her on some steroids by Easter morning. She was walking. And to see that difference between Good Friday morning and Easter, it was like a miracle. And things were going great. She took her first steps, walked around the bed. It wasn't very far, but she could stand. That was something. She could walk. Tuesday night, I'm heading home, and she sends me a text and says, "The staff say I have C. diff." I had no idea what that was, so I had to look it up. And so very cursory, it didn't sound very bad. And then the next morning, I go in there, and they said, "Well, it's getting worse. Her organs are starting to shut down." And Thursday, so that's the year and a week from today, they said, "We have 24 hours to save her or she will die." Not might die, she will die, 24 hours. And what we know saved us was prayers. We know a lot of you were praying for her, and we want to thank you so much for that. We had hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of people on Facebook praying for us. We had at least two church groups that were praying for us. So we are big believers in faith, and now it's on the long road of recovery. But going through things like that, and I know many of you have gone through things that make what we went through pale in comparison, going through things like that can both shake your faith and renew it.
You're listening to a speech I gave to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon.
What we went through pale in comparison. Going through things like that can both shake your faith and renew it. And, faith is like that. It's an ebb and a flow. Things hit you hard. Something causes you to doubt. It's kind of a dance, really. And that's why I think it's important to add reason to your faith. Because if you rely solely on feelings, you may wake up one day and God exists, and the next day he doesn't. And I grew up in the church. But I have definitely had my own doubts over the years and have gotten into some very dark places, especially after my dad died from Alzheimer's. He was one of the brightest guys I ever knew. Graduated valedictorian of his junior college, and by the end, he couldn't remember how to swallow. And it was at a time when I was going through my doctorate, and I thought, why am I doing this? Why accumulate this knowledge if at the end it's just all going to disappear? And so, but it's at times like those that shake us that we really need faith. And the reality is we go through life with incomplete information, and that's where faith comes in. It fills in the gaps. I think of all of the questions in life, the ones that begin with why are often the most difficult, because sometimes they just go unanswered. Sometimes they may never be answered. Why is there pain and suffering? Why is there evil? Why create beings that you knew would end up sinning? And we actually know the answer to that particular why. God wanted mankind to love him back. And so he gave us free will, because without free will, there is no chance to love. If mankind did not have the chance to fail, the chance to say no to God, and the chance to choose something or someone else, if he'd removed our free will, we'd be nothing more than robots. God loves us and wants us to love him back. And if you're a believer, one of the things you'll hear from non-believers is, well, why doesn't God just reveal himself to me if he's real? I mean, you may have asked this yourself. You may have had people ask you that. I mean, we know that one too, actually. Because seeing God doesn't necessarily lead to faith or love or, for that matter, obedience. I mean, Satan was there in the throne room with God, and yet he chose a different way. You had Adam and Eve. They literally walked with him in the garden, and they chose a different way. You had the Jews on the Exodus, you know, it being Eastern Passover season. Did you not see all those plagues? Did you not just walk through that Red Sea that parted? And yet here you are just a few days later at the foot of Mount Sinai in view of what's happening on top of the mountain, and yet they still chose the golden calf. So for people determined not to believe, no evidence is enough. The human mind can be pretty darn creative to explain away the obvious. There's a great saying that I want you to keep in the back of your mind. A little science tends to lead people away from God. A lot of science brings them back. Just as faith ebbs and flows, there's been kind of a dance between faith itself and science, kind of like a pendulum. You know, science would swing towards God. You know, there was something that science could not explain, but then there'd be some new discovery that proves God doesn't exist, and so the pendulum swings back. The Shroud of Turin, actually, again, because it's Easter, this is a perfect example. There is tons of scientific evidence that would indicate that that is, in fact, the burial shroud of Christ. I can't say it actually is Jesus, but for all of the other evidence that we know about Jesus, I mean, it's pretty clear that it's him. But again, with science, they always hedge their bets on that. There are stacks and reams of paper that and research. The Shroud of Turin Research Project went there. I actually had the privilege of interviewing Barry Schwartz before he passed. He was the official photographer of that. And then one carbon dating comes out, and everybody thinks it's a fraud now. And so there's that swing of the pendulum. And for so much of history, science and faith actually coexisted quite nicely. As Christianity rose to prominence, science and faith were still very intertwined at that point. And generally speaking, the Middle Ages, which is what a lot of people consider the dawn of what is real science, they pursued scientific knowledge not to disprove God's existence, but rather to explore nature and the cosmos, to know him better, and to bring others to that knowledge. Many scientists, the early scientists, were very devout. Sir Isaac Newton, who developed the math and the physics to explain gravity and invent the laws of motion, was a very deep Christian. He was a profound theologian as well. And he, like many others, saw the pursuit of science as the pursuit of God. And to understand him better, you needed science. But science did shake religion, theology, and what people believed about the Bible. Up until Copernicus, basically what it was that Earth was at the center. And of course Earth was at the center, because for one thing, they didn't understand there was a whole universe outside of our solar system. But also, because man was the peak of God's creation, of course it would be at the center. But what happened, though, was better math and better instruments in particular shook that belief. And so the pendulum swung back again. And they wrestled with that for about 65 years. And after Copernicus, who had proved mathematically that, yes, the Earth goes around the sun, not the other way around, Galileo invented his telescope and he could observe with his own eyes the phases of Venus. And so that proved without a doubt that, yes, in fact, that math was correct. And what's interesting there is that at the time, you had religious leaders of the day that would refuse to look through the telescope. And, you know, rather than have the faith to trust God, that God was still there, and it's just now we have a better, different understanding of things. New evidence does not have to destroy faith, because, again, faith fills in those gaps, even if we don't currently understand that.
Thank you.
You're listening to a speech I gave to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon.
New evidence does not have to destroy faith, because, again, faith fills in those gaps, even if we don't currently understand that. But what's interesting right now is there is kind of a swing back towards faith from science, of all places. And I find it interesting that this is happening, because one of the things that I find very encouraging is that faith and Christianity is really exploding among young people. The timing of that I find to be very interesting, along with the timing of some of these bits of evidence that, I wish we would hear more about in the mainstream media. And I'm only going to be able to touch on just two areas today in any real detail, but there are discoveries across a number of scientific disciplines. For example, physical sciences like archaeology. For many years, even within the archaeological field, there was open hostility towards the Bible. It seemed like a lot of archaeologists went into it just because they wanted to disprove the Bible rather than prove it. They are finding compelling evidence that proves biblical accounts of history and events to be true. So I'd just like to show you this here real quick. This was the result of the radiocarbon dating after the Shroud of Turin research project had pretty conclusively shown that whatever it was, they knew it wasn't a forgery. They couldn't explain how that image was there. Just real briefly, that image is not a painting. What it is, that image is only on the barest tops of the fibers, not the threads, the fibers within the thread. And there's no possible way that any Renaissance artist could have done that. There's no paint, there's no pigment, there is real blood. And so again, there's all of that evidence that proved the authenticity of the shroud. And then along came a carbon-14 dating that tested one corner of the cloth, which itself was rather suspicious. But there they are, proud as heck that they had disproved the cloth, because that's what the radiocarbon dating showed, is 1260 to 1390. And I can tell you, with all of my scientific training, you don't use exclamation points. That is a picture of people determined to disprove something, and they are celebrating it because they got the results that they wanted. Like I said, though, the pendulum is swinging back, because recently there's been a number of things that prove that the corner that they took that from was actually part of a French weave. And what they do is they would unravel the threads and then ravel in the new ones, because, you know, over the years, I mean, it's 2,000 years, well, at the time it would have been 1,300, it had a lot of handling. It went through at least two fires. People would actually cut pieces off of the shroud for relics. And so that was in an area that they patched. And so, of course, it shows a different date. And now, just I think within the last year, using wide-angle X-ray scattering, which looks at the structural integrity rather than the carbon-14, it shows that the shroud is at least 2,000 years old. So it's funny, though. This was a big international press conference. They had people, I mean, they had press from literally all over the world. It's kind of funny how, now that they've proven that that's incorrect, where's the big press conference? Maybe if they had one, they could have used two exclamation points rather than just that one. So I won't discuss those aspects, the archaeology and all that in detail, but if you're interested to explore that more, I am available for birthdays, weddings, and bar mitzvahs. So all of these things that we were told for years never existed and didn't happen, they are now finding evidence that it's true. But again, no amount of evidence will convince someone determined not to believe. I think it's important to understand that a lot of what we see now as science is very much agenda-driven. And science, like any other field, even religions, can be corrupted, especially when you throw in things like billions of dollars and you're paid to find things like global warming. It is as easy to buy a scientist as it is to buy a politician, and politicians should know, because they're usually the ones doing the buying, because they need some kind of scientific study to prop up whatever policy it is that they're trying to push. Probably the worst thing I hate to hear about science is, and how you know that the science being discussed is almost certainly not science, is this notion of settled science. And its companion phrase that we shouldn't question the science. We certainly saw that in COVID, didn't we? It is the business of science to ask questions, and it is the business of science to question science. And while science certainly has some predominant or foundational theories, science is never really settled. New theories arise, old theories are thrown out, new information, new instruments, new technology. You could certainly hear about, a lot about that. Science is constantly changing. For example, a new and better telescope, which is what had allowed Galileo to confirm that the Earth was in fact orbiting the Sun, and now also new microscopes, as you'll see, have unlocked elements of the cell that were never before possible to see. Theories in science that you would think were settled are being questioned and being redeveloped. For example, two of which I'm going to deal with are the Big Bang and evolution, also known as Darwinism. But unless you actively follow this sort of thing, average person has probably no idea that these two very foundational theories of science are being questioned. And perhaps the biggest settled science of them all that nobody questions, that is actually being questioned now, is gravity. People don't say, oh, of course there's no gravity. Nobody disputes it. Nobody's ever saying, oh, it's not real. We have gravity equations developed by Sir Isaac Newton that we have used to land rockets successfully on other planets after traveling millions of miles. We know precisely the movements and motions of the planets and stars. So people are disputing the math of things. But Einstein's theory of relativity actually opened the door to that. And yet, even beyond Einstein, some scientists are questioning gravity, that perhaps there's more to it. Some of them are beginning to look into things like quantum entanglement. And if you don't know, this is a phenomenon where a pair of particles are entangled, and when one changes, the other does the exact opposite. And they will do that no matter how far apart they are. And so let me give you a quick example here. So this is 3 feet, and unless you brought some binoculars, and I don't see any out there, and the dead center of this is our sun. And you can't see it because it's the size of a period. So when you're, next time you're typing, you're using 12-point font, that's what's in the center of this. And you can come up later and look at it. So here's the thing. Our sun is big enough that you could fit a million planet Earths in it. And yet, using that scale, that sun is the size of a period, and that 3-foot ellipsis represents our solar system. So using that scale, the next closest star would also be a period. It would be 1 mile away. And I looked on Google Maps, and if you're heading back north into Salem, when you get to Ross, that's almost exactly a mile. If you head south, it's the habaneros, Mexican food. And it's mind-boggling to think that that little period of a sun is somehow influencing another period a mile away. So there's also this. So I don't jump quite as high as I used to, but for a brief moment there, I defeated the entire gravity of Earth, which is weird. You know, you think about it. For a brief moment, I defeated the Earth that, according to best estimates, using Newton's equations, by the way, the Earth weighs about 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. That's a 6 followed by 24 zeros, or about 13.1 septillion pounds. A septillion is a trillion times a trillion. So the Earth is 13 of those. And I just beat that mass for a split second. It's mind experiments like that that has people rethinking things. The Big Bang is also something being rethought.
You're listening to a speech I gave to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon.
The Big Bang is also something being rethought. And this was come up with by a Belgian physicist who theorized that the universe began from a single primordial atom, which just happened to exist and exploded into the universe that we see today. And as everything expanded, things slowed down just enough for atoms to form, and then elements and matter, and then on into the stars and the planets and so forth. Well, the Big Bang took a little bit to catch on because it seemed kind of outrageous, but it has been the prevailing theory of the origin of the universe since the late 1930s, but now it too is being questioned. And I think a good number of scientists initially, if you'll excuse the pun, gravitated to the theory of the Big Bang because it became a means to explain the universe outside of, well, God created it. It was an alternate creation story. For those who don't want to believe in God, it gave them something to believe in. And, you know, Einstein himself had doubts about the theory. In fact, he initially jimmied his math in his equations to avoid having a Big Bang. Because in his mind, if the universe had a point of origin, then that could imply a creator. And when I say that they're questioning, rethinking the Big Bang, it's not that they no longer think that the universe isn't expanding or that it didn't have a point of origin. And I say they here in the loosely collective sense here. But sadly, a lot of scientists aren't questioning science and don't want to question science because questioning science might mean you need to look for the answers. And it's a human frailty that sometimes we just simply don't want to look, because the answers could mean we may have to take some action or make some changes. What is happening is they are questioning that it all just happened, a gigantic accident. And what's causing that rethink, again, is better science, better telescopes, better understanding, better math and physics and all that goes into that. And because the more you look and the closer you look, the more you realize it could not have just always existed, that it could not have just happened. And what's driving that is the fine-tuning. of it all, because if things are off even just a little bit, and I'm talking beyond minuscule, as you'll hear in a moment, there has to be a creator, a designer. And there was an interview on the Eric Metaxas show. It'll be on one of those references there. Dr. Hugh Ross, who's an astrophysicist, said, cosmologist actually, he said there's an exponential growth in the evidence for the fine-tuning of the universe. He said, quote, the evidence for fine-tuning gets approximately 1,000 times stronger every month. And that was 3 years ago. So let's look at some of this. That period-sized star, our sun, and again, that's a million times the size of planet Earth, and that three-foot solar system with the next closest star a mile away, I'd like you to kind of lock that into your mind there as sort of our basic measurement here as I describe all this. They estimate that our Milky Way galaxy has between 400 and 600 billion stars. So if you think of that one little dot and the next little dot that's a mile away, and we're on kind of the outer edge of the Milky Way, just try to imagine the immenseness of that galaxy that we live in and how large that has to be with between 400 and 600 billion stars in it. And our galaxy isn't even one of the larger ones. We're on the small side of things. It used to be the thinking that the universe likely contained at least 200 billion galaxies, but now with better telescopes like the James Webb Telescope, astronomers now believe that there are 2 trillion galaxies within the observable universe, each of those galaxies with their own hundreds and hundreds of billions of stars. So here's the first truly mind-boggling fact for you. As enormous as that seems, 2 trillion galaxies with several hundred billion stars each, if you take all of the stars and all of the galaxy and the nebula and the gas and the dust in the universe, that only adds up to about 0.25% of the total mass energy content of everything in the universe. 0.27%. And some estimate that it may be as high as 5%, but even that seems pretty minuscule when you think about it. The vast majority of the universe is actually made up of dark matter, which they estimate takes up about 23 to 27%. And then also dark energy, which is the energy embedded within the space surface of the universe, and that makes up about 68%. And actually, those theories are being reworked as well. But here's the thing. There's a finely tuned balance of entropy and a host of other issues within the universe that need to work. At the moment of the Big Bang, when or if things exploded, if there was too much energy, things would have flown apart so fast that they couldn't ever come together to form the elements that we needed to form the stars or planets, right down to the atoms. Likewise, if there was not enough energy, it either never would have exploded at all, or it would not have had enough energy and speed to spread far enough, fast enough, before gravity kicked in, and then things would have collapsed back in on itself. So just think about that for a second. The universe had to have the exact right speed and energy to throw matter all the way to the farthest edges of the universe and yet not be so fast that it outruns all of the other particles and elements needed to form into stars or anything else. So here's the next mind-boggler.
You're listening to a speech I gave to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon.
So here's the next mind-boggler. What astronomers have discovered is that if you were to change the total quality of stuff in the universe by as little as one part in 10 to the 122nd power, that's a one with 122 zeros behind it, there would be no possibility for life anywhere in the universe. Not just no life on Earth, no life anywhere. So I imagine we have some bakers here. I'm a baker myself, and I love this metaphor from Dr. Hugh Ross, who runs an organization, Reasons to Believe, and again, that'll be on that webpage with the links. Imagine a recipe for a gigantic muffin that calls for a quantity of flour that would fill a measuring cup the size of planet Earth. And we all know how small flour is. Even if you're not a baker, you know how tiny a little grain of flour is. It's like dust, basically. What he says is that that recipe is so precise that if you were to add one grain or take away one grain of flour, then the whole recipe would be ruined and it wouldn't work at all. That's how finely tuned the universe is to make your existence, all life's existence, possible. There are other variables at play that also have to be exactly right for things to work. There's also our friend gravity. If too strong, the expansion necessary in the universe wouldn't happen. As I said, if it's too weak, things keep going. According to Miller, scientists have estimated that the chance to get the force of gravity exactly right is 1 in 10 to the 35. And he gives this example. An average marksman could shoot a 1-inch target at 100 yards away. 1 inch is from the tip of my thumb to my knuckle. So imagine that 100 yards away. There's probably some marksmen in here that could probably hit that, I imagine. You know, don't mess with Republican women. So if you had to bet that somebody could hit that target at the end of a football field, yeah, there's a pretty good chance a lot of people could do that. But the precision necessary to get gravity exactly right, to pull off a 1 in 10 to the 35 shot, would be like hitting that 1-inch target on the other side of the solar system. To get the cosmological constant correct, that's the dark energy that permeates space, hitting that target is 1 in 10 to the 90. The precision for hitting that target is not a 1-inch target, it is the size of an atom on the other side of the galaxy, some 90 million light years away. And just to get a sense of how big that 10 to the 90 is, according to the current estimate, the number of atoms in the observable universe is 10 to the 80. So finally, Dr. Miller said this about entropy in the universe, which deals with the amount of disorder or randomness in the universe. And to get that right, this is 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123. It's not just 1 to the 10, but 1 to the 10 to the 10 to the 123. So if you think of just 1 to the 10, that's a 1 followed by 10 zeros. That's 10 billion. But 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 10 is a 1 with 10 billion zeros. So 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123 is not 1 followed by 123 zeros, but 1 followed by unquadrigentillion zeros. Well, I should have put that up on the screen so you can see how that's spelled. So if you think of it this way, the odds of winning Powerball is 1 in roughly 292 million. You would need to win the Powerball roughly 1.18 times 10 to the 122. You'd need to win it that many times in a row to match the odds of 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123. And you can't lose once. That is the precision necessary to create the order in our universe, necessary for our universe to support life. And remember, you've only got one chance at that. If those variables don't work, if they're not all exactly right, nothing exists. You can kind of see why they're beginning to rethink the Big Bang, that it always just existed and that it just all happened. And this is where it's encouraging, because according to Dr. Ross, there are some 30 space-time theorems that establish beyond any doubt that our universe had a beginning, which implies a causal agent beyond space and time that created everything. Ross says that in the last few years, there have been books published by astronomers and physicists, including some who are self-declared atheists, that among them there's an emerging common theme that we, meaning the scientists, we cannot escape deism, which is the belief in a God. But according to Ross, what they are struggling with is the idea of a personal God. But again, according to Ross, they are at least accepting the fact that there is such a causal agent, that a God, God must exist. Now that I've filled your head with the normative space, which is pretty hard to grasp, even with clever metaphors, let's bring it down to the microscopic level. Living cells seem a little bit more understandable because a lot of us, you know, we've looked through our microscopes here at school. But Darwinism is another major theory of settled science that is being reexamined. There's already currently what's called neo-Darwinism, which kind of uses the essence of Darwin but looks more at the genetic level of things. And the reason they've had to shift just even to that is because they recognize there's some real problems with this. And again, it's funny, in the secular dogma of the mainstream media, it's funny how removing a foundation of secular science never gets mentioned. I'm pretty sure that if Christianity and Judaism decided to throw out its Bible and said, you know, we're going to look for new answers, that might get attention. But there have been entire international conferences, including a Royal Society symposium in 2016, to try to formulate new theories to replace Darwinism, which has faced numerous challenges right from the beginning. And to be clear, though, nobody is disputing the more innocent aspects of evolution, the minor variations on a theme, you know, within a species. You know, Darwin's known for his, the birds, the finches, where they show different sizes and shapes of beaks and stuff. Nobody's disputing that. I used to work for a dog publisher, and that's how you get new dog breeds. You can get them within your own lifetime. You can do all sorts of changes to a dog. It's when you go beyond those minor variations to create new animals from existing animals, that's when things fall apart. No matter how many times you breed a dog, you don't get a cat with an elephant's trunk.
You're listening to a speech I gave to the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon. To find the resources for this show, head to iSpyRadio.com/CCRW2025. And now the conclusion.
No matter how many times you breed a dog, you don't get a cat with an elephant's trunk. But here too, though, science is increasingly, within the realm of microbiology, the evidence is pointing more and more towards a designer, because the closer you look, the less science is able to explain things, and that it all just happened, and that we're all a result of chance. And a major problem with Darwinism and evolution itself, and probably the problem, is that the theories cannot explain the origin of life itself. You may have heard that, you know, when it comes to evolution and the origin of life, that science has this all figured out, that some basic elements were sitting around in a primordial puddle, lightning struck and created some amino acids and proteins, and thus we're off and running towards the first elements of life. But despite the notion that science created or recreated primordial life in the lab, that's simply not true. And yet this is still taught in many classrooms to this day as fact. And what that stems from is an experiment by Urey and Miller in 1952, when they put some chemicals, hydrogen cyanide, carbon dioxide, and ammonia, and I think there was one other one, that were supposed to have been present when life arose, and zapped it with some electricity, and lo and behold, they got some basic building blocks for life. They did manage to create some amino acids, but that's not life. They didn't form life. And what that experiment did was they created two or three amino acids out of the 20 needed to form a whole protein. But more importantly, what that did not show is they didn't show how you sequence those amino acids to get them to fold properly into proteins, because to do that, you need instructions, and those instructions are found on the DNA molecule. 73 years later, after that, science is no closer to understanding this process or being able to replicate actual life creation, although you will sometimes hear things like that in the press that they've done it, and that's simply not true. There's a microbiologist who I absolutely love. His name is Dr. James Tour. He works in the field of nanotechnology, so he definitely knows about the inner workings of cells. He tries to recreate it. They've actually already created some nanomachines that are fascinating. But he says that we've gotten further away from our understanding, because it's just a bunch of protoplasm sitting in cells. It's not just a bunch of protoplasm sitting in the cells. There's a whole amount of machinery in there. And Darwin and his theories and neo-Darwinists say nothing about the origin of life. And Richard Dawkins, one of evolution's champions and evangelists, described natural selection as, quote, a blind automatic process which is responsible for the existence and variation of all life. But the problem with that, with evolution, in the Darwinian sense, cannot be responsible for the origin of life, because evolution presupposes the existence of life. In other words, there is nothing to evolve if life didn't exist first. Watson and Crick, who famously discovered the double helix structure of DNA in 1953, and initially science thought, oh, once again, we've proven that we don't need no stinking God. But it wasn't until years later that Crick, who had a background in World War II as a codebreaker, began to realize that DNA was functioning like alphabetic characters in a written text. And the sequential arrangement of them created a language, the genetic code. And this was confirmed by additional experiments, because what science soon realized was inside the cell, there's a complex information storage, processing, and transmission system. And to explain the origin of life, you have to explain that communication first, because it's that communication that dictates how the cells form and their various functions. And that's the problem, because communication, language, requires intelligence. And as you'll see in a moment, it's not just, you know, DNA just sits there as some kind of encyclopedia of knowledge, you know, an instruction manual. There has to be communication with the various elements of the cell itself, otherwise that information is useless. It's a two-way communication. So something happens within the cell, it needs repaired, that gets reported to the nucleus, the DNA unzips that code needed to instruct the manufacturing parts of the cell what they need to fix the problem, and the repairmen of the cells are then dispatched with the tools needed to fix it. And I'm going to come back around to that here, but as you look into this, and I hope you will, one of the phrases you'll hear is irreducible complexity. And this is a really important concept, and one which evolutionists really don't like, and they'll come up with all sorts of different explanations why what you're seeing is not really what you're seeing. They are working pretty hard to say that irreducible complexity isn't really that big of a deal. And again, no amount of evidence will convince someone determined not to believe. What science has demonstrated over the last few decades is that the cell is run by molecular machines, and really complex, sophisticated ones. And the key point here is that Darwin insisted that his theory worked by numerous successive slight modifications over time. But if evolution built these machines slowly, part by part, and slowly add individual other additional intermediate parts, there's a big problem there, because a machine does not function unless it has all of its parts. The individual part means nothing on its own and serves no function. It would be like you walking through the forest, and you're walking along, and, oh, look, here's the choke valve to a carburetor. I think I'll hang on to that for a few million years, just in case the rest of the carburetor also appears, and just in case an engine ever appears. It's only until all of the parts exist and all of them assemble that the machine is able to function and fulfill its purpose. And what evolutionists want you to believe is along the lines of thinking that a tornado, given enough time, could go through a junkyard, assemble a fully functioning airplane, which would require scooping up all of the existing parts, assembling them in all the right order, including screwing down all of the nuts and bolts to keep them together, fill the tank with gas because the plane needs energy, and have a pilot intelligent enough and skilled enough to be able to fly it. Or to believe that all of that happened by chance, because with enough time and enough tornadoes, eventually it will happen. It's ironic and sad, really, that evolutionists and many scientists, unfortunately, have simply made gods out of time and chance, rather than simply believe the obvious that there must be a God who designed all of this. And what microbiology and chemistry and other scientific fields have uncovered, that, again, thanks to better instruments and able to look closer than ever, is that there is an incredible level of complexity within the cell, and they have likened it to a city. And so I'd like to show you just one of these incredible machines. It's about the flagellum motor. So behave. So that's the design there, and you can see the different parts here. There's a filament, there's that junction there, there's a U-joint, there's all of these different parts here. As I recall, there are 30-some parts to that machine. Not all of them are being shown there. All of those have to simultaneously evolve, and all of them have to simultaneously be in the same cell at the same time in order to assemble that, just apparently because it knows how to do that. So here, let me get this video here.
Due to time constraints, I'm not able to play the audio of that video here, but if you'd like to see that, go to iSpyRadio.com/CCRW2025.
So one of the key points there that I find so fascinating is that little tiny microscopic engine can turn at 100,000 RPM and then stop within a quarter of a turn and turn the other way 100,000. We don't have engines ourselves that can do that. And I don't know if you caught it too, but they said it can travel at 120 feet per second. Scaled up for our size, that would be something traveling at 81.8 miles per hour. A little bacteria. As fascinating as that one motor out on the outside of bacteria is, what's going on inside the cells, your cells, I think, is even far more fascinating because, as I said, it's like this entire city in there. There are power plants, there's energy paths, there's roads, there's public transit, manufacturing, and even things like complex delivery systems, and it's that delivery system I want to zero in on. Kinesin are miniature motor proteins. They're 7 nanometers, that's 7 billionths of a meter, and they're like little delivery robots that you'll see here in a moment that transport cargo around the cells. They're somewhat humanoid looking in the sense they've got two little arms and two little legs. And the arms they use to grab what's called a vesicle, and they walk along on these little nanotubes on two legs, which are kind of like pathways and or roads inside the cell that can kind of self-destruct and be reabsorbed as needed. And as amazing as they sound, they're just one part of our cell's internal diagnostic and delivery system. So a ribosome is a structure within inside the cell that manufactures proteins. And proteins are kind of the parts and toolkits of the cell. To make a needed protein, though, it needs to get instructions or blueprints for those for the part to be made from the nucleus in the form of messenger RNA or mRNA. And yes, I'm talking about that mRNA that we learned about so much with COVID. That's the mechanism that happens with that vaccine. To get the needed blueprint inside the nucleus, which is kind of, if you think of it, it's sort of like the head office, a portion of the DNA, that double helix, is unwound to the exact spot needed for that specific information for that part. It's unzipped, and one side of the strand is used as a template for the complementary RNA, and that makes the messenger RNA. How serious are we? About 5 minutes. Okay, well, let me just fast forward to this then. I won't bother to show you the video. So the mRNA that's sent over the ribosome where it makes the necessary part, another organelle called the Golgi apparatus, packages that part in a vesicle, imprints the address where the part has to go, and summons a kinesin to deliver it. That kinesin is then sent, it grabs a package with its little arms and goes off and walks on its two little legs. But it's not just walking, it's navigating. Because if that road is blocked, it will find a way to get around it, which means that it has to have some kind of sensory to know that its way is blocked and have the intelligence to then find a new way. The Kinesin can also work in teams, hand off packages. They have a power down mode. It's pretty fascinating in terms of all of the different elements of that cell in order to get things done. If you remember that flagellum, it can spin at 100,000 and travel at 81 miles an hour. Scaled up to our own dimensions, that Kinesin would travel at similar speeds and produce as much horsepower per weight as the jet engines of the thrust supersonic car which broke the sound barrier. That's how fast these little tiny robots are moving around. So what we're talking about here is the irreducible complexity. Each point along that passage, that delivery, none of those would have a reason to exist unless that next part was there or the part before it. And you can see why evolutionists and Darwinists are scrambling. A little science tends to lead people away from God. A lot of science brings them back. In high school, I knew exactly where I was going and what I was going to do. But when I didn't end up on the mission field, I felt ashamed and I felt like a failure. But God can use you no matter where you end up or how you got there. Because had I gone there, I doubt very much I would be here today speaking to you. And my prayer is that somebody here or somebody out there listening to this heard what they need to hear, either to find their way to God or to find a deeper relationship with Him, because He wants you to find Him. He has constructed this entire universe so that He could be with you. And I'd like to close with this from Dr. Hugh Ross. I want you to think back to the discussion about the fine-tuning of the universe and how big everything is, and how massive, beyond imagination, it all is, and yet how very finely tuned everything is, from the stars and the galaxy and the solar system right down to the nano-sized machines in our cells. And speaking of the universe, Ross said, that's how much God cares for you, for us. He didn't think it was too costly to create a universe this big with a trillion stars in it to only make up 0.25% of everything in the universe and fine-tune all of that to one part in 10 to the 122nd power so that we can have a place to live. The Bible tells us God knew us before anything was formed. He worked out our salvation before the beginning of time itself. And that's how we know that God is not just a creator, but a personal, loving God who would do anything and did everything to have a relationship with us. And Ross says that implies everything God created is for the purpose of making possible the redemption of billions of human beings from their sin and evil so that we can come into relationship with Him and experience the love He has for us. God is not too small for our problems. We may not understand everything. We may not understand why bad things happen or understand why things happen at the time. Life may take unexpected turns and take you places you didn't want to go. It's okay. We don't have to understand everything. We don't have to understand really anything. It's a matter of faith. Faith fills in the gaps. It is a stunning world and universe we live in, and I hope something I've said today gives you confidence that if we seek Him, we know He cares. We know He cares because of His creation. And with all the evidence you've heard today, the problem is definitely not that God is too small or that He doesn't care. Thank you so much.
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.